This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The Alabama-based Equal Justice Initiative has just announced that it plans to erect a national memorial in Montgomery to mark the country's ugly legacy of lynchings of African Americans. The memorial will be built alongside a brand new museum of America's racial history. Now, the history of lynchings, as most of us know, is a simplified version, one that centers racist white mobs brutally enacting violence and murder on black victims, often in view of large white crowds. But our narratives often do not include black resistance to lynchings, and indeed how the practice of lynchings became racialized in the first place. My guest is Carlos K. Hill. He is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University, specializing in the history of lynching and the anti-lynching movement in the U.S., and he's the author of the new book, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. Welcome to the program, Carlos.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, your book opens with two images, and before we show them to our TV audience, I, of course, want to warn them they are brutally disturbing images, as all images of lynchings are. So I do want to warn you, we're going to put two images up on our screen that you have in your book. And they are of the lynching of a young man named Jesse Washington in Waco, Texas. He was only 18 years old. This happened May 15th, 1916. In your book, you have a picture of a large crowd watching this lynching. And then you have a close-up of the victim's body as well. Why did you open your book with these specific images?
I begin the book with the Jesse Washington lynching and specifically those images because it's the most familiar image of lynching, right? An image in which a black person is at the center, surrounded by whites or encircled by whites. And this, the black lynch victim is being tortured, being brutalized. And in the case of Jesse Washington, he was mutilated and then burned alive. And so I wanted to begin there because it was the most familiar image that we have of lynching. And then from there, I wanted to talk about the unfamiliar narratives, the unfamiliar images of lynching. And so the very first chapter in the book is Black Vigilantism, which is a major departure from what we think about in terms of the black experience of lynching. Right. And so that's why I wanted to begin with those images and then contrast it with black vigilantism.
Right. So we have had these images just in the last few decades really be something that the country, maybe not completely, but at least those who seek them out can find them very easily. But those images reinforce the narrative that I mentioned, that I opened our conversation with, right? That there's basically horrific black victimization surrounded by brutal racist whites. And how does that obscure the broader story of lynching in general in the United States and, as you refer to it, black vigilantism?
In many ways, you know, what I was trying to do in the book is to bring to the surface the submerged narratives, the submerged experiences of black Americans as it relates to lynching. In the main, those experiences and those relationships were not caught on camera as white-on-black lynching was. And so when we look at the history of black vigilantism, and just for your audience's sake, black vigilantism is African-Americans lynching other African-Americans. Those instances, instances of black vigilantism weren't captured on camera. And so we don't have images of those occurrences. And so that's why I think it's been overshadowed or obscured by white on black vigilantism and particularly those very horrific images that you referenced at the beginning.
Right. So how does that history play out? First of all, why was lynching even a thing in the United States, whether within the Black community or within the white community? And of course, we should understand that the idea of whiteness itself evolved. There was a time when people that we refer to as white today were not considered white. A century ago, if they were Italian or Irish immigrants, etc. But how did, why was the practice of lynching even a way to mete out justice, quote unquote, in any community?
You know, lynching or any form of vigilantism arises because there are individuals or groups who believe the normal criminal justice system either will not mete out punishment or will not mete out the appropriate punishment or the level of punishment that is satisfactory for that community. And so because of that discrepancy, some individuals in American history would embrace lynching and participate in lynching. And so lynching goes back all the way to the founding of this country. And actually the term lynching is derived from Colonel Charles Lynch. And Colonel Charles Lynch was a colonel in the American Revolutionary Army. And he became notorious for punishing suspected Tories by tarring and feathering them. And notice that I said suspected Tories or suspected British loyalists. Even if he had very little evidence, he would tar and feather them just in case they were. And so this term lynching is really associated with taking the law into one's own hand, suspending one's due process in favor of, you know, punishment extra legal punishment. And so lynching has always been about the individuals or groups believing that the normal criminal justice protocols are not enough, and so therefore they take the law into their own hands.
Right. You write in your book that it seems that Black vigilantes believed that murder and rape, particularly when women and children were the victims, warranted lynching. Moreover, after Emancipation Delta, Black males were legal heads of household and likely interpreted violent attacks on Black women and children as attacks on their manhood. Why do you think this history of Black vigilantism is not better known? Does it undercut the narrative that has been painted of lynching as solely a white-on-black crime type of practice?
It does undercut it, but only so much. And I say that in part because when we compare the history of white-on-black vigilantism or white-on-black lynching to Black vigilantism, there's no comparison. There were about, and this is just an estimate, about 3,000 cases of whites lynching an African-American, about 3,000 cases. In comparison, there's only about 148 cases that we've found, that historians have found, of an African-American or a group of African-Americans lynching another African-American. And so there's simply no comparison in terms of the frequency between the two phenomena. And I think in part that's why Black vigilantism has been forgotten. The most important part, maybe the critical part of the story, is that the NAACP, the oldest civil rights organization in America, in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, really put a lot of pressure on Congress to pass an anti-lynching law, a federal anti-lynching law. And the story that they told Congress was that Black people, particularly Black Southerners, were being victimized by lynching. And so the NAACP lobbied Congress for 30 years. They never succeeded in getting a federal anti-lynching law, but they did succeed in changing Congress's mind and attitudes towards Black lynch victims, who typically were seen as Black beast rapists. They did transform Americans' ideas and attitudes towards Black lynch victims to see them as, helpless victims that were deserving of their civil rights. And so it's a complicated story, but I think it's the narrative that we have today is, you know, it's come about because of the NAACP's tireless organizing, as well as sort of, you know, the relatively few cases of Black vigilantism.
Now, did the NAACP's opposition to and struggle against lynching form the bulk of resistance to the practice of lynching? Or were there other instances, particularly of Black resistance to lynching, that have also kind of faded away from memory?
The NAACP between 1920 and 1930 tirelessly organized for a federal anti-lynching law. The NAACP had the most sustained anti-lynching crusade in American history. However, there were other individuals, there were other groups that were trying to either prevent lynchings or to punish lynchers. And so in the book, I talk about Ida B. Wells. And Ida B. Wells is a Black female from Mississippi who moved to Tennessee, founded a newspaper that criticized and was very critical of lynching, and then ultimately moved to Chicago, where she organized not just an anti-lynching, local anti-lynching movements, but also more broad-based, you know, social, political, economic reforms. And so Ida B. Wells, I would argue, in the 1890s, is really the founder of the modern anti-lynching movement. And it's without Ida B. Wells and the kind of rhetoric and the kind of tactics that she engaged in, we may not have seen or saw the NAACP emerge in the 19-teens and have the kind of methods and tactics that they did. And so there's definitely Ida B. Wells that we can give credit to as an anti-lynching crusader. And I can mention others, but just to answer your question directly, there were a variety of people. There were organizations, there were ordinary Americans who, after a lynching, would organize indignation meetings. They would submit petitions to local politicians, state politicians, asking for state anti-lynching legislation. And so the anti-lynching movement was a broad-based movement, but the NAACP, particularly after 1920, was at the center of it.
Talk about, you mentioned this in passing, this narrative of the, quote, Black beast rapist. Victims of lynching, Black victims of lynching were often basically accused of raping, sexually assaulting, or some way marring the sexual mores of whites when they were taken out of sometimes police custody and brutally lynched. How common was this narrative, and how did groups like the NAACP try to counter that?
You know, the Black beast rapist narrative emerges in the 1880s as America is becoming a segregated country. And the Black beast rapist mythology or narrative really revealed the anxieties of white Americans. The anxieties that white Americans, particularly white males, had was that African Americans were going to be competing with them economically and politically, as well as socially. And what that meant socially was that they were going to seek to marry white women, or at least have interracial sex with white women. And so there were a lot of anxieties that white Americans had after the Civil War, with African Americans becoming equal to them. And so the Black beast rapist narrative expressed those anxieties. And in particular, the Black beast rapist narrative hinged upon this idea that Black males, or emancipated Black males, were retrogressing back to their slavish character. So there was this idea that slavery had, to a certain degree, civilized Black Americans, Black men in particular, but without slavery, African Americans were regressing back to their sort of bestial, slavish-like personas. And so what many argued was is that African American men, because of this, were increasingly raping or attempting to rape white women. And so in the white imagination, normal forms of retribution or punishment were not good enough to coerce black men from, or to convince black men to cease and desist from raping, attacking white women or white people in general. You needed something spectacular. You needed a spectacular form of violence to demonstrate, you know, African Americans' place or the place that they should have had. And so that's where lynching came into, this is why lynching in many people's minds emerged as the appropriate solution to black criminality. And so the Black Beast Rapist narrative was a narrative that white people told each other about why lynching was necessary. And it was important for whites who were, to a certain degree, saw lynching as inconsistent with American values, or, you know, just a dehumanizing process. It was a way to get them in line as well, because with the argument went, there was nothing else that white people could do to coerce black people to cease and desist from that kind of behavior. And so the NAACP understood that they had to develop a narrative that directly attacked this black beast rapist narrative. And so what they tried to do is first and foremost convince the American people, in particular Congress, that African Americans were human beings deserving of civil rights. And that African Americans, it wasn't African Americans who were anti-American. It was actually the mob who lynched them, who were anti-American.
And then the tide began turning as the NAACP and media coverage of lynchings began to turn the tide against lynchings, and states began to pass laws and ordinances against it. This idea of black victimization began to take hold. And you write in your book that the black authored victimization narratives of the lynched black body emphasized how white mobs lynched black Americans with impunity, and how black lynch mob violence dehumanized, of white on black lynch mob violence dehumanized powerless blacks. But in that context, you said, although victimization narratives were politically expedient, they had limited use for creating a sense of empowerment among blacks. Can you expand on that thought a little bit? That, of course, when we do create sympathy for community, we risk disempowering that community as well.
Yeah. The victimization narrative was an expedient narrative. It was a narrative to create sympathy among white audiences, particularly congressmen, who saw in black men criminals, rapists, etc. And so in order to create sympathy, in order for white Americans to see African Americans in ways that would lead them to the conclusion that anti-lynching legislation was necessary, African Americans had to be helpless victims. They had to be essentially non-threats to whites. And so you can imagine how this is not an empowering narrative for black Americans. It's only a narrative that's useful for convincing whites. It's not a narrative that's useful in consoling African Americans. And so this is what I argue consoling narratives, or more empowering narratives of lynching, became necessary, because what African Americans are trying to do is to overcome the trauma of lynching, and using narrative as one of the primary means of doing so. And so in the book, I talk about literature as well as oral history memory. But in the main, across those two genres of memory, African Americans, when they were reflecting on lynching, wanted to talk about African American resistance to lynching, and in particular, African Americans fighting back against white lynch mob violence.
Right.
And this was an important narrative because You know, even though those African-American lynch victims who fought back were ultimately killed, it wasn't really about them fighting back and winning. It was about them fighting back and providing a model for other African-Americans to follow.
And so in your book, you reprint the poem by Jamaican-born poet Claude McKay, If We Must Die, a really powerful poem, which is up on our screen for our TV audience. And I'm wondering if you can either paraphrase it or maybe even cite some of the lines, and why that poem in many ways exemplified what you were just saying about, even turning the practice of lynching into something that African Americans could turn around on its head and make empowering.
Yeah, I mean, Claude McKay is very important to the book and as well as to the moment in history in which African Americans had to deal with lynching. And what Claude McKay is essentially asking, the question that he's posing to African Americans is, how do we respond to terror? How do we respond to lynching? Do we cower in the face of lynching, or should we meet it head on? Should we fight back? And so in his poem, he characterizes an African-American lynch victim at their most vulnerable, when they're encircled by a white mob with nowhere to run, no way to escape. What should that black lynch victim do, right? Should they fight back, or should they try to negotiate in some way to get a lesser, you know, so that they might not face the harshest form of punishment that was possible at the time? And so what Claude McKay is seeking to do is to say, even in this context, in your most vulnerable, even though resistance will be futile, fight back, demonstrate your humanity, demonstrate that you have not given up your civil and political rights, demonstrate that you are not afraid and that you have not been intimidated by the mob. And in doing so, you can claim a measure of victory even in defeat. And if African Americans in total could do that, imagine how powerful that could be. Right. Imagine how empowering that would be for the community. And what I often say to people is, can you imagine the civil rights movement occurring without the anti-lynching movement occurring?
Right. The last line of that poem by Claude McKay, like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. A really powerful poem. Well, I want to ask you, Carlos, today we are living at a time when rather than the horrific photographs of lynching as a measure of white on black violence, we have horrific videos of police, often but not always white, killing African-Americans. Some people are very clearly making the connections between the lynching of past times and what they see today as lynchings as well. In fact, the NAACP would fly a flag after lynchings happened, saying a man was lynched yesterday. Some activists have taken to doing something similar. There are photos of flags. A man was lynched by police yesterday. Are those parallels appropriate?
They're appropriate to a certain extent. I should say first and foremost that police shootings of unarmed African Americans and classic lynchings are not the same phenomenon. They are dramatically different phenomenon for a lot of reasons, which I can't get into right now, but they are fundamentally different. Now, I am in agreement with activists or people who would say that there are some resonances, even deep resonances, between police shootings of unarmed African Americans and lynchings. And just to, you know, probably the most appropriate one, or the one that's most appropriate, is the kind of terror and fear that these police shootings have instilled in Black communities. You know, I'm a you know, upper middle class, African-American male, never been in trouble with the law, never been pulled over by a police officer. But after seeing multiple videos of African-Americans being shot and killed when they're not, without being armed and not being threatening, has sent chills through the community, and in particular through me. And so I understand the terror. I feel the terror. And lynching served the same purpose. The goal of a lynching was to publicly execute an alleged criminal. But the real goal of lynching was to send terror throughout the community, right? To send shockwaves throughout the community. Because what lynching ultimately was about racial social control. It was a means to keep Black people in their place, to keep them from agitating for their social, political, and economic rights. I'm not saying that this is the same thing that's what's happening with police shootings of African Americans. What I'm saying is that the kind of terror that Black people experience after a lynching and the kind of terror that Black people feel after they see these videos of police shootings are very similar. So that's one of the deep resonances between these two phenomena. There are other ones, and if you have time, we can go into them. But, you know, if you put lynching and these police shootings side by side as phenomenon, they are not one and the same.
Right. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but Carlos, we're going to have you back on to give us a historical context through which to understand what is happening today in the United States. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with your book.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, Sonali.
Carlos Cahill is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University, specializing in the history of lynching and the anti-lynching movement in the U.S. He's also the author of the book we've just been discussing, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.